Our next speaker is Michal Sadon from Children's of LA and USC, and she's going to give an overview of lung and airways in systemic inflammatory disorders.
So I feel like it's a perfect segue for me because I met Rashmi in 2014-15 when Vikram was only one, and I'm one of the pediatric rheumatology attendings, a junior faculty at the time. And patients like Vikram really prompted me to think about what my role is as a clinician in moving the field forward. It doesn't take a lot to care about a patient or to feel connected to patients like Vikram and their families, and you feel like you have to take some ownership beyond being a good clinician. You have to kind of be part of the thinking process involved in moving the field forward. So thank you, Rashmi. I think that you kind of moved me along as a physician, and I think a lot of people in this room as well. So I just wanted to share that. So let's see. This segment of presentation is a little bit a departure from yesterday because, as I said, I'm a clinician. I'm a pediatric rheumatologist. And my presentation hopefully will give you an overview of where the field is in terms of our understanding of pulmonary manifestations of pediatric rheumatology diseases. Also, again, my presentation really underscores the interest and need of clinicians to collaborate together to determine how to effectively manage these conditions. Okay, so the overview overall that childhood interstitial lung disease is fairly rare, right? What we know is 1 out of 100,000 as opposed to 30 out of 100,000 in adults, so it's exceedingly rare. And I don't know if Robin is in this room, but she basically said it takes a village, right, to understand this, and it's truly the case. Okay, so what I'm going to focus on in terms of outline is threading a number of topics that focus on specifically on the immune dysregulation associated with pediatric conditions that have a pulmonary manifestations, talking a little bit about the epidemiology leading to the pathogenesis, talking about the management of these pulmonary diseases in the context of rheumatology disease, these rheumatologic diseases, and some of the limitations and barriers that we're facing based on our current knowledge, which ultimately lead to a roadmap to understand what are really the future directions we need to take with the research. And many of you in this room are very familiar with these themes. Okay, so childhood interstitial lung disease really represents a heterogeneous group of pulmonary disorders where there's an abnormal exchange of air, right? And but really, as Kristen Kuo and Lisa Young demonstrated or noted in a published article, it's really more accurate to say that we're dealing with diffuse lung disease. And why? Because we're dealing with the upper airways, and also we're dealing with the lower airways as the distal bronchioles and the alveoli. So it's really much more accurate to speak about diffuse lung disease. In terms of the classification of diffuse lung disease, yesterday we spoke about diseases which affect children under the age of 2, right? But I'm going to focus on patients who are affected by diffuse lung disease above the age of 2, and namely talking about disorders related to rheumatologic conditions. What are they? Namely, connective tissue diseases like lupus, overlap syndrome, juvenile dermatomyositis, a cohort of patients that have ANCA-associated vasculitides as well, and also a small cohort of patients that have JIA, and more specifically systemic JIA or poly-JIA, rheumatoid factor positive poly-JIA. And some patients have sarcoidosis as well. So this is a very small cohort of patients. What I want to point out in the classification of diffuse lung disease, here's a classification of disorders of immune-compromised host. If you're a rheumatologist in this room, you'll know that if these patients have active rheumatologic disease, they're already immunocompromised. They're also affected by medications which lower their immune system. And some diseases like systemic sclerosis have a vasculopathy component to it. So I just kind of wanted to share that with a group. Okay, so In terms of the epidemiology, the most common rheumatologic diseases which affect kids are the ANCA-associated vasculitides, namely GPA, or formerly known as Wagner's. You can see, no, I had to point it out here, 80% here are affected, very comparable to the adult population. As we go down the row, percentage of cases are affected by this disease. Lupus patients are affected, 25 to 75% of them are affected by some type of pulmonary disease. Systemic sclerosis, up to 40%. There is a subtype of disease which is more, speaks of interstitial lung disease, but also pulmonary hypertension is something that we have to deal with, either on its own related to the vasculopathy or secondary to interstitial lung disease. Sjogren's syndrome, unlike adult population, it affects mainly the upper airways, okay, which is interesting. Juvenile dermatomyositis, it's a fairly biphasic disease, and we don't really see it in younger children, but we see it in much older children. GIA, although it's really described in a fairly high proportion of patients, in adult patients, 10% overt, 30% occult, and sometimes it can happen prior to the articular disease. In GIA itself, it really represents a very small section, right, of patients who develop pulmonary disease. But Vivian will talk to you about a special cohort of patients who have systemic GIA. In itself, it's fairly a small subsection of a subtype of juvenile idiopathic arthritis. And out of that whole group of systemic GIA, a much smaller percentage, which she'll tell you more about it, up to 60 patients have been identified as having pretty serious pulmonary disease. In sarcoid patients, mostly it's occult or subclinical, up to 50% can have pulmonary involvement, but it's seen much more in the older children. You really don't see that much in the younger age groups. What you can really appreciate is what I wanted just to point out, that these patients have a high level of acuity when they come in with pulmonary disease, and especially with pulmonary hemorrhage. Many of them end up in the PICU needing plasma exchange and cytoxin therapy. And they require, you know, coordination of complex care long-term and very close monitoring. This disease kind of for the most part, a fairly indolent course, although I've seen a few advanced cases at Stanford, sort of 8-year-old, 9-year-old kids that ended up actually needing a lung transplant. But overall, I just wanted to point to the fact that, you know, that you need a lot of health services utilization for these conditions. Okay, so in terms of epidemiology, I just wanted to kind of share with you further, you know, the incidence of these diseases is exceedingly low, which makes it very, very difficult for us to study these patients. So we really need to work together. I did mention to you an ANCA vasculitides GPA, but also Churg-Strauss has a high percentage of pulmonary involvement, to a lesser extent MPA. Lupus, you have a constellation of different types of pulmonary disease. The most common is having pleural effusions or pleuritis, although you can have acute pneumonitis, up to 10% of patients. Some of them have thromboembolic disease and can have other sort of more rare complications as shrinking lung syndrome, for instance. In terms of systemic sclerosis, what we're most worried about is interstitial lung disease and also pulmonary hypertension. But that usually does not, well, interstitial lung disease, you can detect it fairly early in the course of the disease. Pulmonary hypertension, usually not. What I wanted to mention to you also on the right side, if you see it there, that there are some, I did a review this year that kind of looked at some of the risk factors associated with the development of pulmonary manifestations of rheumatic disease. There are not many of them identified, as you can see on the right side. Okay, but there are a few of them sort of that I wanted to kind of mention to you. So for ANCA vasculitis, you can have typically staph colonization plays an important part, where you need to treat these patients with you want to treat these patients with Bactroban to reduce the colonization. There's also an association with particular antibody profile that make us much more concerned that these patients tend to develop progressive pulmonary disease, such as MDA5, for instance. Okay, so really the $64,000 question is, how do we manage the lung disease in context of the pediatric rheumatic disease? And it's a troubling question because sometimes certainly there is not a strong association between these two immune dysregulations. And the medications also play a role which we don't really understand very well. Okay. So this leads us to talking about a little bit of what we understand about pathomechanisms associated with a pulmonary disease. The mechanisms underlying the lung disease are fairly heterogeneous and multifactorial, and manifest probably based on the interaction of the genetics, the microbial triggers, the autoantibody-driven tissue responses, cellular immune dysregulation, and tissue-inherent fibrotic pathways. And this is a review, again, of what the current literature identifies as specific immune cells that are associated with specific rheumatologic diseases. In ANCA vasculitis, the neutrophils play a very prominent role, as well as the expression of specific surface antigens as proteinase 3. In lupus, we know there is a strong consumption of complements and an immune complex deposition. In systemic sclerosis, fibrosis plays a very prominent role that's driven by multiple cytokines. In sarcoidosis, it's primarily sort of what's pointed out is that it's a T-cell driven disease. And in rheumatoid arthritis, this is primarily data from adults, not kids, right? Rheumatoid factor, citrullination of the lung pathways is clearly well described as well. Okay. I wanted to mention to you, in our field, we use a lot of immunosuppressive medications. And it's not really clear what is their role in causing or being associated with pulmonary disease. Methotrexate is the main culprit. It's found in up to 0.3 to 11% of cases. Most cases are described within the first 2 years of use. Leflunomide is also is a medication that's implicated in pulmonary disease in this in rheumatic disease, and it's actually interestingly seen more in patients who have used methotrexate prior to leflunomide, and it's not really understood why. Rituximab is associated with acute and subacute organizing pneumonias, sulfasalazine with eosinophilic pneumonitis, anti-TNF with sarcoid-like lesions, which represent granulomatous inflammation. And tocilizumab, although now it's used in pulmonary disease in systemic sclerosis, it's also associated with organizing pneumonia, allergic pneumonitis. And Echinra, this is something that Vivian will talk about a little bit, has been seen in patients, have been used in patients who developed pulmonary disease. These patients, in terms of pulmonary disease, some of them developed ILD, alveolar proteinosis, lipopneumonia, as well as pulmonary hypertension. So clearly, this is a very confounding piece here. Okay, but most of these cases are case series or case reports, and that's the good news behind it, because as a rheumatologist, we need to use these medications. Okay, so in terms of what are the lung issues, all components of the lung can be affected with increased prominence of certain clinical pathologic patterns by specific rheumatologic disease. So I think you can appreciate that airways, well, here is more common. I mentioned to you Sjogren's, pleural effusion, pleuritis in most of these conditions as well. And then varying levels of interstitial disease, varying from acute level of acuity and chronicity as well. Vascular disease is very prominent in lupus patients as well as systemic sclerosis. So these are things for us to consider. This is just turning the former chart in a representation that how a rheumatologist sees a patient, I should say. So when we're talking about pulmonary disease associated with rheumatologic patients, I think a rheumatologist thinks of various pulmonary things that can happen to the patient. Okay, so I can give you an example. I had a patient last month who had a new diagnosis of lupus, and she didn't present with any respiratory issues at all. Her chest x-ray was completely clean. There was some neurocognitive delay and very severe cytopenias. Okay, great. So we said, okay, fine, we'll treat this patient with rituximab. We treated her. Well, initially we treated her with steroids, and 2 weeks later she came. She had a pulmonary bleed. We thought she had a pulmonary bleed. Well, actually, what is the truth here, actually, is that she developed antibodies to a number of different factors, okay? And secondary to that, she developed a pulmonary bleed in the lung. But this is a representation of what certain patients can do. They can have multiple problems related to the lungs, some of it related to the systemic disease, some of it related to different types of pulmonary disease in the lungs as well, okay? So when a rheumatologist thinks about their rheum patient, they kind of think about the laundry list of things that can happen related to the pulmonary disease itself, but also systemic things that can influence the pulmonary disease, as this example, for instance. Okay, so the most common changes that are seen from an imaging perspective, the lungs of these patients are related to inflammation, which is ground glass opacities, reticular changes, but also to the other spectrum, you can develop some honeycombing bronchiectasis, which reflect more long-term inflammation and scarring. There are various radiographic patterns described in the adult, more in the adult world rather than kids, for instance. Nonspecific a pattern is very representative of most rheum conditions, but in particularly systemic sclerosis is very common to it, as well as lupus. There are some other patterns which are described in the adult world, such as organizing pneumonias, which are more common in rheumatoid arthritis, for instance, and some of them denote a worse prognosis or not, but it's not really clear how they play a part in children and imaging related to children. But what we do know is the radiological patterns do correlate with functional tests, such as pulmonary function testing and a 6-minute walk test. But really little is understood how these radiographic subtypes correlate with the lung progression and the prognosis overall. Okay, we would like to say that we understand the phenotype of these rheum patients, like which ones will present with a particular type of pulmonary disease, but we have a very, very limited understanding related to it. Okay, so that's the truth behind this. Okay, so the easy part is actually to define the lung disease. And the first thing is obviously to rule out infection, immunodeficiency, recurrent aspiration, various comorbidities, as congenital heart disease or cystic fibrosis or specific mutations, like for instance in surfactants, or in particular surfactant C. The primary diagnostic tools we clearly use over and over again, bronchoscopy, really helps us sort of rule out infection, hemorrhage, tells us about aspiration, tells us about PAP, chest CT as well. But we don't use all these modalities to make the diagnosis, right? The harder part is really sort of to figure out how to use these modalities for initial screening and how to monitor these kids, okay? These standards have not really been defined in pediatric rheumatology. It's standard of care to basically do a chest CT and pulmonary function testing and echo on patients, for instance, who have systemic sclerosis, or have ANCA vasculitis, right? But there are no really clear guidelines that describe that in kids, okay? Most of the data really comes more from the adult world, where they're much more focused on the phenotype of these patients and trying to stratify the risk of needing to do a chest CT or pulmonary function testing or an echocardiogram, for instance. And it's really not clear also how we need to monitor the pulmonary involvement or the pulmonary progression of these children as well. Okay. The easy part as a rheumatologist is to evaluate the inflammation, the systemic inflammation, but many times it doesn't really correlate very well in terms of what is going on with the lungs. The role of antibodies as biomarkers, as ANCA and double-stranded DNA, and other markers like MDA5 and all that pathologic stuff, right? It really varies per individual what it clearly it denotes, right, in terms of disease activity and so forth, okay? I think it's not really clear if patients who have high, remain ANCA positive, right, through their lifetime will have a higher risk to develop exacerbations of their underlying disease, or whether those titers reflect something that we need to really focus on quantitatively. But this is an area that needs to be worked on as well. When we see patients, we initially kind of do a fairly large, we call it a rheumogram, where we do a sort of a very comprehensive autoantibody profiling of these kids. Kids who have myositis involvement get, we obtain myositis-specific and myositis-associated antibodies. We typically don't track these antibodies. They just get, as part of their initial evaluation, we get these studies, but we don't track them thereafter. We also, for the most part, some children we evaluate for immunodeficiency, and now there's a new area of interferonopathy that that some genetic studies are tied to as well. In terms of therapy for pulmonary disease, it's largely empirical and reliant on studies with adults and children. So the data is primarily derived from open label, case series, and retrospective studies. The data on the therapeutic approaches in rheumatologic disease is often not tailored to the diffuse lung disease or sufficiently longitudinal. So this is some of the limitations that we face. There are no therapeutic guidelines have been established to really treat pulmonary disease in context of the rheum condition. The first thing we do, obviously, we try to remove any environmental causes. And as Rashmi said, we really, really focus on aggressive treatment of the underlying disease. But as we know, sometimes the control of the systemic inflammation related to or control of the rheum condition does not correlate very well, right, with the pulmonary disease. So there is a bit of a disconnect there. In terms of therapy, really, there's limited reports in terms of use of steroid-sparing medications, such as methotrexate, Imuran, Celcept, cyclosporine, rituximab, and cyclophosphamide on GIA patients. And I'm not really describing really the cohort of systemic GIA patients. Where the deep data is, as it relates primarily to the adult population in terms of having some randomized studies and more enriched cohort of studies that that deals with pulmonary disease associated with systemic sclerosis. Cyclophosphamide historically has been the go-to medication to treat pulmonary manifestation of systemic sclerosis. We typically, there is an induction phase, a pretty aggressive induction phase, but now there are some studies as the European study in systemic sclerosis and the randomized study in the adult population for connective tissue disease that utilizes rituximab and also looks at MMF in terms of its overall equivalency to treat to at least stabilize the pulmonary disease and the pulmonary function testing of these patients. In terms of ANCA vasculitis, I can say that at least at Stanford and in CHLA, we have used cyclophosphamide, but looking at the literature, it's been sort of the go-to medication. There is now more a credence, at least in terms of induction therapy, to try to go with rituximab if the renal disease is not very strong. Okay, and the role of phoresis is not really clear in terms of induction therapy to help these patients overall. Sarcoidosis, steroids work very well. We typically commit patients up to 6 months of therapy with very slow taper, and methotrexate is used as a steroid-sparing medications. There are other second-line medications as Imuran and mycophenolate, as well as now a sort of a cocktail therapy of antimicrobacterial medications that have been used as third line, second line and third line approaches to treat pulmonary disease. So hopefully this overview here kind of made us kind of reflect on all the uncertainties involved in how to manage pulmonary disease and rheumatological conditions. It's really, there are many uncertainties here. really, it's not really clear the mechanisms that drive the development of inflammation and fibrosis in the lung, the connection to immune dysregulation and the connection between the immune dysregulation and the primary rheumatologic disease to what's going on in the lungs, the role of medications, right, in the development of lung disease, disease models. We don't really have a clear understanding of certain disease models we can use to learn about the predisposition to pulmonary disease. Certain genetic predispositions, such as surfactant mutations and MHC class 2 variations, how they affect the pulmonary disease is important to sort of understand as well. And overall, there's lack of longitudinal studies in children and also adults that identify factors which are associated with disease progression and prognosis. Additional questions that I have is which patients with rheumatic disease are predisposed to lung disease, really identify risk factors. It's really, really important. And how do we detect early lung disease early? And is it going to make really a difference for them if we do detect it early also, right? How do we design safe and therapeutic interventions that improve the clinical outcome of the lung disease, the progression, and the prognosis? And so the future direction is really we need guidelines to screen and diagnose diffuse lung disease in sort of at-risk patients. So we need to understand who are these at-risk patients with rheumatic disease. We need biomarkers for diagnosis and disease activity. We need biomarkers that predict disease risk, progression, and prognosis. And we need studies on genetic susceptibility to diffuse lung disease. Okay, so as individuals in this room, including Daryl, has mentioned, really we need a collaborative working relationship among clinicians and researchers. Things that I'm thinking about and working on at CHLA right now is developing registries to inform the phenotype and endotype of these patients, trying to think of how to sort of develop biorepositories for these patients so I can send samples to various individuals in this room who can characterize their immunophenotype profiling and genotype a little bit better as well. And I think that's kind of the direction that we need to work with overall. Okay, thank you.
Question, and it's a little bit bizarre, but we've seen some overlap of intestinal-driven disorders like celiac disease and inflammatory bowel disease with systemic inflammation and lung involvement as well. And then I noticed you had put on there a sleep study as a part of the workup. Both gut inflammatory disorders and sleep disorders now are increasingly linked with microbiome changes, and I wonder if anybody's looking at microbiome alterations in folks with systemic inflammatory disorders and how that might.
So I know that plays a big role in autoinflammatory disease. There are quite a few studies that actually are looking at stool and sort of the makeup of the stool right now and how it influences inflammation, autoinflammatory disease inflammation. Oh, sorry. I know that there are studies now being conducted focusing on autoinflammatory disease associated with the gut flora and the stool composition as well. In terms of its influence on pulmonary disease, I'm not really aware that, there are ongoing active studies right now, but maybe someone in this room is aware of that. The symptoms related to pulmonary disease or a rheumatologic condition? So many of them, that's a great question, actually. I'm sorry that I kind of was a little bit nervous and kind of skipped that point. But yes, I mean, I would say, patients with lupus, ANCA vasculitis, look, there are some diseases where we know if we treat the disease, right, we're going to be able to tackle the pulmonary disease, and probably we're not going to run into complications in terms of scarring, okay? Even ANCA vasculitis, that it's really a scary disease, but it's really a scary disease primarily because of the renal involvement and the renal scarring involved. I know very few patients that need a lung transplant. I mean, there are a few, right? But not a large majority that need a lung transplant related to ANCA vasculitis, okay? I think the same applies to lupus. I mean, there are some conditions which, for instance, like systemic sclerosis, I would say, right, where there's a very strong pro-fibrotic tendency. And these patients, especially the ones who develop pulmonary hypertension, yeah, those are very, very challenging patients to treat overall. And the subset of patients that Vivian is going to talk about, the systemic GIA patients, right, there is a clear, to me, there's a very clear disconnect between the disease itself and, I mean, although these patients have very, most of them have very active systemic GIA disease overall in terms of their systemic GIA phenotype, there is a disconnect between what's going on with the lungs and the systemic GIA. Like, we can get the systemic GIA under control, but once the horse is out of the barn, you know, with the pulmonary disease related to these patients. So clearly there's different types of immune dysregulation that we don't really understand. And there are different pathways for each disease. Each disease uses different pathways related to the immune dysregulation itself, I would say. Hopefully that makes sense. Yes, Robin. Right.
I think there's a lot to learn about vasculitis and vasculitis through those disorders, the COPAGENE, and understanding if there's generalizable neutrophil vasculitis, capillaritis disorders that fuel this. So it doesn't make your list as a distinct entity, but it's certainly one that we in this room see. Common more than the other things that you see as a shared list. And then, though rarer, the GPA airway lesions, you can
you can, right.
Those,
yeah.
That don't necessarily tie to your systemic disease. Those are just a few my observations that we struggle with and need your help with.
All right. Thanks very much, Paul, and I'm sure we'll have more.